The Paths to Parenthood podcast is designed to support those needing to use a donor to build their family. I'm Becky, also known as Defining Mum, and I'm also the founder of Paths to Parenthood. I'm the mum to three amazing girls, all thanks to egg donation.
And I'm Hayley King, the founder of All Things Donor Conception. I'm both a donor conceived person and, in a twist of fate, the parent of donor conceived children with my lovely wife.
Our aim is to open up conversations about this incredible route to parenthood, focusing on some of the nuances and complexities that it can bring.
Our hope is to provide different perspectives, information, reflection, and validation as we openly discuss different topics, share stories, and ask you for your input.
We hope you enjoy it.
So, welcome to the Paths to Parenthood podcast. Our podcast is designed to open up honest conversations around donor conception, family building, and everything in between. And today we're exploring a topic that we haven't really spoken about with two amazing experts. We're going to be talking about using a known donor to conceive at a fertility clinic and talking about everything you may need to know and hopefully answering all the questions that you may have. And we're hearing more and more about people going down the known donation route. There's a lot of nuance, a lot of complexities, a lot of things you may need to know. So hopefully we're going to cover off some of those legal, medical, and also emotional factors that you may need to think about today. I'm also joined by my co-host, Hayley. I'm going to hand over to you now, Hayley, but hopefully we're going to answer lots and lots of your questions throughout the next half an hour.
Thanks, Becky, and it's great to be back. And like Becky said, we're going to be tackling this subject today. And it's a subject, actually, that I don't think I've heard many other people discussing around using known donors, but at a fertility clinic, and some of the things that you may need to consider or how that might look like for you and your partner if you have one. And like Becky said, we're joined by the lovely Anis Mathias, who is a family law solicitor at TV Edwards, and the lovely Mr. James Nicopoulos, who is a fertility specialist doctor at the Lister Hospital. So I just wanted to introduce, if you could just say a little bit about yourself. So Anis, could you just come to you first and just explain to our audiences, if they've not come across you before, your role and what you do?
So in general, I'm a family solicitor and I advise clients about all areas of family law. I do, on the wider side, I do divorce, separation, child arrangements following separation, but I also have quite a niche area about parenthood following donor conception and modern parenting, and I've had 4 reported cases on it. So I advise parents who are considering donor conception, and I advise them about parenthood and responsibilities and then drawing that up into an agreement. And then I've also been involved in post-birth disputes where there's been a dispute about who is the actual parent and also how much time each child should spend with each party.
That's great, Anis. And I think over the last few years, I've got to know Anis. She's done some chats with us on the Hub around legal parentage. So if you are a Paths to Parenthood member, we do have some more content around that topic. And Anis is my go-to if I've got a question. If there's something in the media, I always ping it to Anis and she's good as gold and comes back to me. And so James, I'm just going to come to you. So yeah, if you just explain a little bit about your role and what you do on a day-to-day basis.
I am a consultant gynecologist who specialises in IVF and fertility. I'm the clinical director and the person responsible at the Lister. And the person responsible is a bit of a daft name that the HFEA give to the person who's basically the buck stops with the person responsible at the clinic in terms of making sure that everything we do follows all the HFEA regulation. We're an incredibly well-regulated sector, possibly the most regulated sector in medicine. And I quite enjoy all of that regulatory stuff, as well as the fun of seeing all the patients and trying to help them along their journey.
Thanks, James. And like I say, you do such great work. And we're actually, just to give a little bit of context to the recording of this episode, as we're sat here, James is on his lunch break and taking some time out in between seeing clients. So we're super impatient. So we're super grateful for him being here. And like I say, we are going to be talking around known donation. We are going to touch on, I suppose, the different environments in which people can use known donors. I think, as Anis touched on there, some of the cases that you tend to see have been the ones that have maybe involved at-home insemination, or where maybe some of the paperwork has not been completed correctly. But James, I just wanted to come to you first, actually, because I know Becky mentioned that she did consider known donation through a clinic route at one point. Is it something that you're seeing, you know, at your practice and at your hospital?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've long, you know, performed lots of cycles with known donation. I think it's becoming slightly more prevalent, not massively so, but we do see a lot of it, both in terms of using a known egg donor and using a known sperm donor. I think it's definitely an option that people need to be aware of. Sometimes they're not, and it's important that for us, when people come talk to us about their options, that we make sure they know it is. So it is something we do a fair amount of.
Yeah.
I was just gonna say that's really interesting because I mean, it was 10 years ago now, I was on my own journey looking into egg donation and what this means. And actually it was bizarre, but on a forum, somebody said to me, I'll donate my eggs to you. And I'd never even considered that people did that with somebody that they knew. It hadn't been presented as an option. And I remember seriously considering it and calling up one of our local clinics. I think she lived a little bit further south. And I was just not given any information about how that might work. It was almost just given barriers to, oh, no, we don't really do that here. We don't do that. We just use our egg bank and our list of donors. And I'm not quite sure how that would work. And so I was sort of instantly sort of put off that experience because I thought, oh, it feels too complicated. And it sounds like something that people don't really do. Now, things may have moved on in the last 10 years or so. I suppose today we often think about at-home insemination, we might be talking about the LGBTQ plus community, but this could be anybody that's considering using a known donor, whether it's a family member, whether it's a friend, whether it's somebody who you meet online. And I think it is so important for people to have that level of information because actually it can be a really amazing route. And we've shared some incredible stories on Paths to Parent Hub of people who have used a known donor, whether it be a family friend or otherwise, and it can really work, but there's a lot of things to think about first. So I suppose maybe the first question is, what do you need to consider? Maybe, and if this is more for you, if you are using a known donor, what are the first things you need to really, really start thinking about?
I mean, for me, the first things really are what relationship everybody would have with the child and to really understand what you would want out of that. Because if you can do that and everybody's in agreement, then it can be great and it can be really fulfilling. But if it's one party might say, for example, you've got the donor might be saying, well, actually, I want more of a relationship. And the mother is saying, I want the donor to have a limited relationship. You're going to end up in disaster. So it's more about really making sure that everybody is on the same page and everybody's understanding what they want out of it and what they expect out of it.
And are there differences between egg donation and sperm donation when it comes to known donation?
I don't really advise people about egg donation. And I think that's because when you have egg donation, it's very clear that you're donating your eggs and that the woman who carries the child and gives birth to the child will be the child's legal mother. Whereas with sperm donation, it can be a bit more of a grey area and the sperm donor may have more of an involvement depending on whether or not there's partners involved. But I think I've not had any cases where an egg donor has sought to have more of an involvement.
And I was saying, because we've talked about this a lot, Becky, haven't we? And we think within our communities that we speak with, I think the idea is that you, certainly with sperm donation anyway, within the LGBTQ plus community, which I'm a member of, you either have the kind of narrative of the known donor at home, and that's one route, or you have an anonymous or an open ID donor at a clinic route. But what we wanted to discuss today is actually you can use a known donor, but at mm-hmm. a clinic. And I suppose, Anis, you see, like I say, sometimes people that are maybe looking to do the at home route and maybe want some advice, preconception donor agreements, which we can touch on in a bit. But I suppose, James, I wondered if we could come to you. If, say, for example, you had a couple that did want to use a known donor at one of your clinics, what would that look like? So, like, is there like a process that you would start with?
Yeah, and the key with everything we do is about making sure people have as much information as possible. And as Becky was saying earlier, I do think maybe there was an element, and maybe there still is now, of it's a trickier route, so let's not encourage it, which just seems completely unreasonable. Commonly, we have known donors, you know, be it siblings, for example, who live in Australia or in Japan. And actually, it's not, even then, it's not really that hard, because as long as you go through it step by step, because the first step, obviously, is that known donor, having counseled the people who want to use the known donor, that's the first thing, clearly. And we would have gone through the implications of that in terms of the anonymity laws, how they work in the UK, the success rate of any treatment that they're going to go through. So step one is making sure the person who's using a known donor knows how we're going to treat them, success rates, implications of the child at 18 being able to access that information, and how that may apply to that particular setting, and how important it is, as Aness said, of discussing what is and isn't going to be known, the role that person is going to play. But from what, you know, once a decision is made, then clearly that known donor needs to have a full consultation, be aware of exactly the impact on them clinically, physically, clearly significantly easier with a known sperm donor than a known egg donor. But if we look at sperm, step one is consultation, semen analysis, counseling. Is the sperm good enough to use? Is it going to give us the chance that we want? And then that the known donor will see the counselor, go through the implications of treatment for him now and in the future. Then they'll have a little bit of a cooling off period, a couple of days or however long they need to decide, is this something that's right for me? And again, all that can be done remotely. Don't have to live around them. If they're then happy, step two is all those regulatory requirements in terms of tests, infection screen, physical examination, genetic screen. And again, all that in theory can be done wherever they are in the world, as long as they're doing the right tests. And obviously by this point, as part of the consultation, we would have made sure there's no health issues or family risk issues that would prohibit them from being a donor. Once all those tests are done and all those results are back, we're then ready for potentially to actually collect in the freeze sperm. So step three then becomes they come in, freeze perhaps two or three samples, enough to make sure that whoever's using that sperm got a good chance. And then we have a, depending on the type of test, if you're using a really accurate test, then we have a 3-month quarantine period. 3 months after that sperm is frozen, we have to do one more virology test just to eliminate that tiny risk of sperm being infected at the point of being given, but that test not being visible for 3 months. 3 months later, if the infection screen is normal, they're then free to use that sperm. And obviously at some point through that process, we always recommend a joint counseling session as well, just to cover some of the things that Aness has discussed. And we will always normally recommend or suggest they, you know, they do have a legal framework in place as well, just to make sure that things are in place. So basically, step one, consultation, counseling, step two, tests, step three, quarantine. And then we're good to go from a known donor point of view.
Yeah. I suppose it's quite helpful to hear the steps, because I think actually listening to you talk, James, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it does seem it's very similar to if you were maybe using a donor from, say, a sperm or an egg bank in terms of the tests that are done on donor, the registration of the donor and all those kinds of things as well. It does seem very similar, which I think is quite reassuring.
Yeah, the only difference is obviously if a woman or person was going to use a sperm donor from a sperm bank, by the time they're going and looking at the sperm bank, everything I've spoken about is already done.
Yeah.
The most important thing to know is that it's going to take 4 or 5 months, possibly longer if it's hard to come by and they live somewhere else, for them to be able to start treatment. So that's the main difference between using a known sperm donor.
Yeah.
I was just going to follow up on that, James, with just if anybody's listening and they're considering using a known egg donor, so they may have a friend or somebody they know that's wanting to donate their eggs. I mean, obviously a very similar approach, but could you just give a summary of what to expect when using a known egg donor?
Yeah, it's very similar in terms of, you know, I always say it's a 3-step process. Step one is making sure the recipient of the eggs, again, has the counselling about the family dynamic or the dynamic in terms of long-term, the treatment, if they're comfortable. Step two is we see the known donor. In that particular case, they need to be counselled about, you know, how an IVF cycle works, because that's what's happening for them in theory in terms of stimulation, what that's involved in, the implications for them. You know, reassurance that it's not going to impact on their long-term fertility, because that's often a worry. Am I going to go through the menopause earlier because you're taking all of my eggs? Reassuring them that's not the case, reassuring them about the risk and what will be involved. And from then on, actually, the tests are going to be very, very similar. There isn't the need for that screening process, for that quarantine process with eggs in the same way as there is sperm. But the tests, the counselling, the joint counselling, all of that is going to mirror things. And the other factor, obviously, we have to think about with eggs that we don't have to do with sperm, unfortunately, is the impact of age. If we're providing a donor for somebody, then the donor should be 35 or below, because success rate is based on egg age, unfortunately. If somebody's providing a known donor, and then we have to counsel them about the implications of age, because I do think having a sister, for example, donating is an exceptional circumstance that should mean you're allowed to use that donor if they're above 36. But it's important they know how that may impact on success rate and, you know, bringing that conversation in.
That's really helpful. Thank you, James. And I suppose coming to you, Anist, around that legal framework that James referred to there, what are the sort of things you should be thinking about when putting in place a legal framework, particularly if you're using a sperm donor?
So the clinic has an obligation through the HFEA to make sure that all the parenthood consents are in place and that's all understood. I had people come to me and they've got agreements where they're looking at wider issues and some of it would be covered by the clinic consents. So for example, I've had an agreement where somebody was talking about whether sperm could be used in the event of death, could be used for siblings, how that sperm could be used. But the agreement also just covers a few wider issues, because generally if somebody's having a known donor, they might be saying, well, we'll have contact every so often, maybe once a year, every 6 months. But it's also they're asking the donor to keep them informed about other children. And there's an agreement about that. And likewise, the recipients will be saying, we'll keep you up to date as to what happens with treatment. Some of it is not quite so enforceable, but it's just really looking a bit more about practicalities.
And I've always sort of interested, Anist, with the consent paperwork that's done at the clinic, which is obviously, like you say, that's my wife and I remember doing it. We didn't use a known donor, but we used a sperm bank donor. And we, as myself, who wasn't carrying the pregnancy or using my eggs, remember doing the consent paperwork, but having that reassurance that I would be recognised as a legal parent once our children were born. And I suppose that would be the same as if you were using a known donor. Is that correct? So if you would say we were using a known donor at a clinic, that same consent paperwork, does it work the same way at a clinic as, say, if you were using a sperm or egg bank donor?
It should do.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. Yeah,
exactly the same. It's the same consent forms that we'll be getting us to use, whatever the donor type is, just to make sure that, yes, the legal parenthood is in place for any child born from the fresh cycle, legal parenthood is in place for any child potentially born from subsequent cycles, should anything happen to the parent as well. Right. So lots of factors that come into play, but it will be the same whatever type of donor you use.
Yeah. And I think, like, going back, Anist, I know you were touching on some of the, like, the agreements that are maybe in place when you're using a known donor, which are maybe more to do with like the social side and how you're going to navigate any potential contact. And that I suppose comes under the preconception donor agreements that you maybe see. Is that side of it legally binding at all? Because obviously I think some people think, right, we can get this preconception agreement, whether at a clinic or at home insemination, but are those pre-donor conception agreements legally binding at all?
No. So they would be, in terms of if somebody's married and there's a consent to parenthood, then that would be upheld. But if there was child arrangements, then the court would look at what's in the interest of the child at the time, and the court would look at the child's welfare needs as opposed to what was signed in an agreement.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people think, don't they, I'll get this conception agreement in place and then that protects me if I'm doing it at home. But I think what we wanted to try and explain is that actually you can have some of the benefits of a known donor using them at a clinic. So you have the legal parentage consent paperwork, which sometimes I think people don't realise the kind of benefit of doing that. And yeah, like, I know, Anist, you've seen some of the kind of fallouts where people have maybe done at-home insemination with a sperm donor and things have gone wrong, sadly. Mm. And then there's custody battles or legal battles that follow. Do you think that a lot of that happens where people are maybe going into it, they're not very well informed about the different options, or what do you think is...
There's generally a degree of optimism when you're entering into this agreement and you don't know somebody that well. You can be... Human nature is to be optimistic about somebody, and human nature is to trust somebody. And for me, I say to my clients, and sometimes I give them advice and they just go away and they'll say, well, why am I going to pay for it if it's not binding? And I think, well, that's fair enough. But I will go and give them topics to discuss and topics to think about. And for me, that's more about considering compatibility. And if they start talking about those topics and they think, oh, actually, we're really not on the same page, then they've got the opportunity to go away. And for me, that's the most important thing about an agreement rather than what's actually in the agreement.
Yeah, Yeah, that makes sense. Because we see it, Becky, don't we? We have a lot of questions come into our membership and people don't really know where to go to get the information and all that kind of thing, doesn't it? It tends to be a lot of confusion.
Surely it's about an awareness of what could go wrong, really, isn't it? As Ness is saying, you can't put anything down on paper that will stop things going wrong. But if they've at least thought and had an Ness's counsel and advice as to what could happen in certain circumstances, they can then make an informed decision as to whether they're willing to take that route.
I think it all links back to the kind of whole concept we talk about with donor conception, that it's not just that one-time decision, it's a decision for life. And you do need to allow yourself, whatever type of donor you're thinking of using, is to fast forward to the point of not just, I think often you're so in the mindset of getting pregnant and having that baby that actually fast forwarding and having that child that's growing up and actually relationships change over time as well. So I think what you're saying there around those whole, the social side of things, how often do you have contact? What does that mean? Is just as important to almost have those conversations from the outset, but have that, whether it's legally binding or not, but having that framework to almost work towards and facilitate those discussions. One of the things I was interested in, Anis, was kind of not to scare people in any way, shape or form, but where do you see things go wrong? Kind of what scenarios would you say are the scenarios to potentially avoid for people?
So I think it needs to be really clear that if you're in a relationship and you're using a known donor at home, you have to be married or in a civil partnership for the partner to be the legal parent of the child. Otherwise, the donor's the legal parent. And I've had clients where their partners had a child and then they've separated. And it's been really hard for them to get that relationship with the child that they view as their child, but it's not legally their child. And people can be really vindictive and horrible. So that's one thing, that know that if you're going to do it at home, you have to be married or in a civil partnership. Otherwise, you have to go to the clinic. I've also had it where my client was married, but became impatient about how long it was taking to conceive through artificial insemination. So she thought that she would add in sex. And that then meant that her wife was no longer the legal parent of her child when it went to court. That was quite a difficult one. And the sperm donor is now the second legal parent.
Yeah, that was quite a recent case, wasn't it, Anis? I remember reading about that one. And like Becky said, we don't want to scare people at all. And we know lots of situations. I know lots of very personal situations, friends of mine that have used that home insemination with a known sperm donor, and it's gone amazingly well. But there are those cases where it doesn't go to plan, or things end up happening later on down the line and things get challenged. And then sadly, we see the fallout of that. And I suppose, to put it really crudely, if you're going to use a known sperm donor, if you're using that person at a clinic, then there potentially is no dispute over the fact that, you know, that sex did or didn't take place, because you've gone through a clinic, you have the consent paperwork signed, you're in a medical facility. And I think that's where, for me, on a very personal level, where my wife and I have had discussions around our choices. And I do appreciate I'm coming from a point of privilege that we could afford fertility treatment, because we haven't really discussed, obviously, that's one of the big differences, is that if you are using a clinic, whether a known donor or not, it is going to cost more money. But we also wanted to explore what some of the benefits of using clinic-based treatment are. And I wonder, James, if we could touch up a little bit on the cost. Is there any difference in price for treatment if you're using a known sperm donor compared to, say, one from a sperm bank or
I think it's a really good question. I don't even know exactly what the cost of a vial of sperm is now from a bank. It's probably around somewhere £900 to £1,000, I would imagine, for a vial of sperm. And if you were going to get three vials to maximize your chances of perhaps more than one child, or if you need more than one cycle, that may cost you £3,000. The extra cost of using a known donor is the consultation, the screening, which is probably going to cost you about £3,000as well. So it's going to be relatively cost neutral. And the cost of using a known egg donor may be marginally more because some of the tests and the screenings, but again, it's not going to be massively different.
Yeah.
The one other thing that came to mind earlier that we're seeing more of is that, frustratingly, you know, women get to a point where they often need to seek treatment with an egg donor because either cycles aren't working with their own eggs or there's some issue with egg quality. And if you're a woman who needs to use donor sperm, classically what would normally happen is that I've got a sister who's going to donate my eggs. But in that scenario, we're often seeing people who've got a male sibling and they're actually sourcing anonymous donor eggs and using a brother to provide the sperm because you're still getting that genetic link. Genetic. So we're seeing that more and more. And people initially raise their eyebrows, oh, you're using your brother's sperm. But actually, genetically, it's exactly the same. I just happen to have a brother, not a sister. So we're doing more and more of that occasionally where things get slightly more, not complicated, but it's important that the counselling comes in the conversations. I've got a patient at the moment coming through who wants to use their father as a known sperm donor as backup. And again, just adds a little bit of complexity to the discussions.
And I suppose that's where the counselling must really come in.
Absolutely.
As well, I think, which is something that you might not have the opportunity to have access to if you're doing at-home insemination. I think the clinic very much encouraged under HFEA guidance to have counselling. And like I say, we know some amazing counsellors, don't we, Becky, through the work we do. And we really can't recommend having counselling enough. And I think certainly in the known donation situation or some of the kind of situations that James has mentioned there would really benefit from that, as well as having the medical expertise of a clinic. You're also getting the psychosocial support, I suppose, through what you can offer there, isn't it, Becky? It's quite important.
Yeah. And I think, James, at the Lister, you do provide that counselling, and that is kind of multiple sessions, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, we've always kind of I felt that level of importance can't be, you know, can't talk about it enough. And it's something that we've always provided. Patients don't have to pay for counselling sessions, whether it be implications once you've decided to do something or support counselling. You know, 18, 19 years on from the donor anonymity laws changing, we're getting people who are coming back 18 years later as people who've used donor gametes to help them with the concept of their child potentially seeking the information about the donor. So yeah, even 18 years on, it's important.
Yeah, and I think that is so important for a clinic to be offering that, because I don't think you can cover even a tenth of what we've just talked about today in one counselling session. And it was really interesting what you were saying, James, around the use of kind of male siblings for donor sperm where donor eggs are being used. And I think we don't hear about these stories enough. So it only feels like the times you hear about it are sensationalised headlines in a tabloid newspaper that make it seem really weird and icky. And actually,
icky.
When
icky
things
is
are really
the word
well,
I always use, isn't it?
Icky, yeah.
Yeah.
And when it's well thought through and you've thought about the implications and you've put those things in place, like Anna said, it can work really well. You can maintain those genetic links. But like you say, it's just a whole other layer of complexity that I think some people are dealing with. I think one thing I do want to just point out, and I think one of the real benefits of using that known donor is around the medical history and being able to have direct access to that. But I just wanted to sort of comparing that with an open ID donor, James, in terms of the information that is given over time, if somebody's thinking all known or open ID.
Yeah.
How does that work from a medical history?
With our any donors, open ID donors, we obviously take a full history, family history. We also, it's not a mandatory regulatory requirement, but we do it. We also go back to the GP of anybody who's being a donor and ask for any factors, because, you know, not out of any malice or anything, people might not realize that something in their medical history is relevant. So we always go back to the GP and ask, is there anything else there that you think might be relevant in terms of this person becoming a donor? We also, and it's a two-way thing, interestingly, we ask the donors a direct question, you know, should anything come up in a child that's born with your donor eggs or donor sperm, do you want to be informed? Because it might be something that may affect you and your children. Equally, years later, if something were to be found in a donor, we often get communication from sperm banks to say, look, this has been found in this donor you've used, and we have to go and inform, if relevant, somebody who's used that donation. So we do get as much information as we can, but obviously if it's a known donor, you've got that access to have that direct conversation yourself.
Yeah, thank you. And Anis, is that something that's sometimes included in the legal agreement around that responsibility to update around medical?
Yeah, that's included. Yeah. And I've had people fill out health forms as well when they've signed the agreement. They've both given, also all three parties are giving information about their health.
Yeah. Yeah, because we often overlook, don't we? I think we talk a lot around from the parents' perspective. So worrying about, you know, parental responsibility or legal parentage, all those things. But then actually a child is created at the end of this who, you know, we need to look into the future and things that they may want to know. And I suppose for me, with my donor conceived person's hat on, Anest, I think everyone says, you know, well, if you use a known donor, then yeah, you may have contact and all the rest of it in order to get that updated history or be able to answer them questions. But we do know, obviously, a lot of people do use donors that maybe they don't know very well. They may have sourced them online or wherever. And I suppose I just wanted to ask you around, what are some of the kind of legal consequences of someone using a known donor outside of a clinic where, of course, the donor's information isn't recorded necessarily? So obviously with a HFEA clinic, if a donor's used there, that information is recorded and stored with the HFEA and a child at 18 can get that info. But I'm assuming that doesn't happen in the at-home insemination world.
No, it's all on trust. There may not be a way of knowing. It's trust that the donor will inform you about other children, and it's trust that they would find them. But it's, in theory, you could have, like they talk about, that relations are more likely to be attracted to each other, and in theory they may find it, like people may form a relationship and not know that they're related, but it's all trust.
Yeah, that, I think that's what, in relation to siblings, is it? I think, and I know there's been a lot of cases in the media recently of what we call, I suppose, the serial donors, where lots of children have been created from one donor in the private donation setting, I suppose. And I'm just thinking that, yeah, I mean, some, obviously, if it's a known donor and it's maybe a family member or someone that you're very close with, then you'd like to think that that relationship or that opportunity to contact them in the future would be there for that future child. But I suppose that isn't always the case with some known donors. So it might be another reason to potentially use a clinic, because that information is stored by the HFEA, and that child could gain access to that, as well as their potential siblings' information that donors also used again at a clinic or whatever. But yeah, I mean, we've covered a lot today. I'm very mindful. James is taking his time out on his break. I don't want to take too much time away from your work. But I'm just wondering if, like, just some takeaway advice, Becky. I think we're always interested, aren't we, when we have expert speakers on, just to find out what your takeaway advice would be to anybody that's maybe considering these paths.
Yeah, James, what would you say to anyone who's considering a known donor? What sort of piece of advice would you give to them?
I think probably two-pronged. I think if you're not considering using a known donor within a clinic setting, my piece of advice is go see Anest, talk about everything. Yeah. I think if you're thinking about using a known donor within the clinic context, probably like anybody, I would say you've got to feel comfortable in the clinic you're having treatment. Go and speak to two or three clinics, make sure they're used to doing it, make sure they do it well, and make sure that they don't make you feel like you're being a pain because you're asking to do it, because then it's probably not the right place to do it.
Yes, I think that was my learning from my own experience. I wished I'd have asked around a little bit more. But Anest, what about you from your experience? What advice would you give to someone who's considering this, whether they're considering at home or doing it via a clinic?
I mean, my preference would be via a clinic, because I think you've got all the safeguards in place. And I think that you've got, and their counselling is invaluable, I think, that there's all the screening, and you know that the clinic will take care of the parenthood and ensure that that's done correctly. There's also the issue that actually going through a clinic, you're probably more likely, well, I don't know, James would know this one, but I want to say that you're more likely to be successful sooner through a clinic than at home, because the doctors can guide you on what you need to be doing treatment-wise. But I'd say take your time to think what you really, really want to achieve out of this. Obtain the advice about how that can be achieved. So think about parenthood, think about relationships, and then follow through with it and follow your gut. If there's something telling you this, something's not right, follow your gut and don't do it.
Yeah, these are huge decisions, aren't they? And not just for yourselves, but for your future child as well. And I hope that today, if you're listening, it's just given you a few more things to think about and maybe just a bit more clarity over, like I say, I don't think I've seen this really discussed very often in kind of the general arena around how do I make this work and what do I absolutely need to consider before going ahead. And we know that there will be nuances and complexities for every individual family, whether it be finances, whether it be other issues. I know I've remember speaking with Laura Rose, who is a big advocate for the LGBTQ plus community, who said that actually for many, there may be different reasons from the past that actually they feel much safer doing it at home. But it's also building in the safety of the information and kind of that future child and the relationships that are there as well. So there's lots to consider, but it sounds like there's two amazing places to go if you need that help. If you want to find out information from the medical perspective, obviously James and the team at the Lister Clinic, and then also Anist is a font of knowledge and the person that you will always need to speak to when you're considering this. Hayley, have you got anything you would like to add before we finish up?
Just to say thank you very much for your time today. It's been super interesting. And I wish I'd have had this podcast episode to listen to back 7 or 8 years ago when we were looking at our options, because I think it would have been really helpful to hear from both Anist and James. So thank you very much for your time today. And Anist is going to be joining us through the rest of this series as amazing supporters of season 3 of the podcast with TV Edwards. So we're looking forward to speaking with Anist a little bit more in the next few episodes. But thank you very much for your time today, both.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
A huge thank you to TV Edwards for supporting this episode. TV Edwards are a top-ranked, award-winning law firm named in the Times Best Law Firms 2025. Their family law department is ranked among the UK's top 20 and known for their expertise in family law with a compassionate, client-focused approach.
They lead in modern family law, supporting clients through surrogacy, donation and co-parenting. Their solicitors have shaped landmark cases for many diverse families.
And with TV Edwards, families gain more than legal support. They find a trusted partner for their journey ahead.
Becky and I are so grateful to be supported this season by TV Edwards solicitors. And we're thrilled to welcome family law solicitor Anist Mathias to the Path to the Parenthood podcast. Throughout this series, Anist will be joining us to answer some of the most common legal questions we hear from our community around donor conception, surrogacy, and modern family building. We are excited to be bringing you those all important lived experience stories, but this time alongside the legal insight, because we know how valuable it is to hear both.
Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do take a moment to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't forget our free resources, including our recent webinar, Why Telling Matters, our friends and family resource, and lots more via our website.
So do come and join us in the Paths to Parenthood membership. We'd love to see you there.
Until next time.